Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Good evening, listeners. I am Carolyn Yeager, and welcome to the Monday, October 31st installment of the Heretics Hour, being broadcast over Talk Show tonight because Voice of Reason Radio is not available right now due to a snowstorm power failure in Connecticut. Sound odd? You wonder how that works? Well, I'm not going to try to explain it. If you have been to VOR website, the explanation is posted there. I just want to say that I'm grateful for those of you who have found your way here via my mailing and maybe through word of mouth. If you go to carolynyeager.net, you will be able to listen from there also. All right, tonight's topic follows from last week's program on painting and sculpture in the Third Reich. Right after the show was over, my guests last week, Wilhelm Christman and Rodney Martin, and I decided to follow up this week with sculpture and architecture. And we even have another subject scheduled for next week, which is going to be education in the Third Reich, and that will really be fascinating. So I just didn't want to have to break this series up and wait another whole week before we did tonight's program. I'm not a very good waiter. So with the help of William Fink of Christogenia.org, we have set up this Heretics Hour program page on TalkShoe, and we're able to record do the program from here tonight. And maybe we'll be doing it, doing some others in the future from here. I'm sure we will. So I want to welcome Rodney Martin. Hi, Rodney.
Hello. Happy Halloween, Carolyn.
Well, I'm doing fine. Yeah, happy Halloween to you. you know, we don't have Wilhelm with us yet. I was talking with him just an hour ago, and he was going to be calling in at 6 o'clock his time, and yet he may be having some problems with it. I hope not, and I hope he I told him to send me a Skype message if he did, but I haven't gotten anything. So we will just start out here. I've been looking up architecture and sculpture in the Third Reich all week, and I've got also information about the Autobahn and the Volkswagen, and it's all very exciting what was taking place in Germany by Germans in these two fields. And I'll just start out by saying that I have mentioned before that the general consensus is that painting did not reach the levels of architecture and sculpture during the Third Reich period, which we could say between 1933 and 1944, say. And I think that that is true. While there was a lot of good painting, and it actually disappointed Adolf Hitler. That he didn't find things paint art in the realm of painting that was more impressive than he did, but he was always still encouraging, and there were some very good painters. But in you can't say that well, of course, and we said that I said that was not true of music either, because music was fabulous. But in the fields of architecture and sculpture, it was really reached a high level of achievement. What would you say? Would you agree with that, Rodney?
Oh, absolutely, Carolyn. And I think painting reached a high level of achievement. It's just that the it was just so suppressed at the time by the Marxist Judeo art world outside of Germany. But there was a tremendous amount of cultural tourism that went into Germany before the war, and had an appreciation of the paintings, and we didn't quite get that far in our discussion last time. But the topic that we're going to talk about tonight, architecture and sculpture, it was kind of hard to suppress that because too many people saw the fruits of German labor, saw those beautiful buildings, the design, and saw those buildings. There was too many world leaders that were around after the war that had been in the Mosaic Hall of the New Reichs Chancellery and just marveled at that design. Too many people that had been in, and of course this building still exists, the House of German Art, and it has an appreciation for architecture, and even, you know, people that may publicly make statements against the architecture and sculpture, probably in private circles, would have very good things to say. And, you know, the while we're waiting, I'm sure Wilhelm Crispin will catch up. You know, I was going to confine my topics to mainly architecture in the three main areas of Berlin, Munich, and Nuremberg, because you've seen a tremendous, and then some examples of, you know, getting into architecture and design. There was the first master, truly master plan communities started taking place in National Socialist Germany beginning in about 1935. And that has gone largely unnoticed. People really don't realize that until you start pointing to what are now renamed communities, and I hope we can talk about that. Truly master plan communities, you know, you hear about the in the United States, the you know, suburbia. Well, Germany, you know, Germany was, you know, 20 and 30 years ahead on so many other, all the other Western nations, and, you know, light years ahead of the Soviets. The Soviets just stole everything, and of course, so did the Western powers as well. But
let me give a little background, Rodney. Let me give a little background here with Adolf Hitler himself. Now, we know that that he was a painter in his younger years, and that's what he thought he wanted to do as a career. But he was drawn more and more to architecture. He had always been drawn to architecture, buildings, and so on. And in fact, when he was a teenager with his friend Kubitschek, they would wander around. They walked around Linz, and he would discuss the buildings and tell his friend, you know, how they should be done, and what was wrong with them, and how he would improve them. And he would, you know, he had all these ideas, and he was even sketching, doing architectural sketches then, I think. But he got more and more attracted to architecture, and he himself continued to do architectural design. And many of the buildings that were built during his time by well-known architects were based on sketches that he had done. And I wish we could show pictures during this radio broadcast, because, you know, it's just one beautiful image after another that we could be showing, and particularly, though, his sketches. I'm sure some of our listeners have seen them. He was very accomplished in doing exact architectural-type drawings of what his ideas were, and he had all kinds of ideas. And as we go on, I might just mention now because I might forget. Like, for example, the opera houses that were designed during the Third Reich all ended up with this concave front, you know, rounded front, and then straight square ends on either side. Very attractive looking. And that came from him. And he first came up with that. And then he gave his ideas to the architects, and they were doing that. And that became kind of a style for the opera houses. So he was more involved then in architecture than he was in what the painters were doing. He certainly wasn't doing any painting, you know, at that later on. And, of course, he didn't do sculpture either. But sculpture was often used as a part of the architecture, as we know, not only the figures, like in the announcement that I sent out of the Reich Chancellery with the two Arno Breckers, huge, these are much greater than life-size statues on either side of the entrance to the in the honor court.
Those were entitled the Army and the Party.
Yes, yes. This is a way of incorporating sculpture, you know, with the architecture, but also a lot of sculpture was done that wasn't figurative freestanding statues, but that was relief sculpture on building fronts or even eagles and decorations on buildings that are put on there in a form of a relief thing. And Arno Breker actually did a lot of those. So
hello.
So that's where we stand with maybe why it blossomed so well. That's what I'm trying to say. Architecture may have blossomed so well because Adolf Hitler was not only supportive of it and very involved in it, and wanted to do a lot of new building right from the start, as you said about the House of German Art. And he was also an inspiration for it.
Well, what's interesting, a couple of things, look at the House of German Art. It was commissioned in 1933. So isn't it interesting, Carolyn, that essentially the first major building project, lasting building project under the new National Socialist government was a museum? It was a museum. And it still is there today.
Yeah, I made that point in an article that I wrote about Hitler as in the Reich being a Reich of art and culture. That's really what he wanted. And we're going to be able to show, I think, during this program that the interest that he had in redesigning Germany, not only the architectural and the whole city replanning ideas that he had for these. You want to talk about those cities. Where he did some redesigning of the entire central city so that it'd be much more impressive and express the feelings of the German people better than the kind of a hodgepodge that cities become, you know, after a while. And all of these projects that he had, including the Autobahn Volkswagen, show that he never would have wanted war. And of course, he didn't want war. He was trying to bring the German Reich back together without war, and he thought he could. He was being successful in it, and thought he could continue to be with just one more deal with Poland, and then that's when they came down on him, and in created World War II, and they created World War II, and he had to either give in to their demands, you know, give in and go along with the. With the Allied Jewish Allied person, or he had to stand up to him, so he tried to stand up to him. But he certainly was not interested in going into a huge war and taking over the world. He really wanted to do this cultural work that he was had already begun and was so involved in Germany. You can't want to build and want to destroy at the same time, and he couldn't have been so dumb that he thought that he could go into a world war and he wouldn't suffer any devastation in Germany.
Well, he wasn't even planning,
right,
Carolyn, on staying in power forever. He made a stated goal that he was planning on retiring to essentially be an artisan. So the business of him being this fallacy of him being a madman and a dictator and wanting to rule the world, that was all false. He'd stated over and over that his plans were to retire to Linz and to rebuild Linz to be the artisan capital of the world. You know, that's a noble goal. We all would like to have our own home city.
Well, I don't know if he wanted to make it the artisan capital of the world, but of Europe, he wanted it to be a major city in Europe. Yeah, cultural city. Yes.
And he was still planning, making those plans and reviewing plans towards the last days.
He wanted to retire. He wanted to enjoy all this that he liked so much. He didn't want to continue to be the leader, but he also wanted to find someone who could be. He wasn't going to just walk away and let it all come apart. He was very, very concerned with his National Socialist policies continuing because
absolutely.
He thought that's what was best.
But, you know,
let's get back to the architecture and the museum, because as you said, the first building that he had constructed once he became the chancellor and then the Führer was this House of Deutsche Kunst, in Munich, a huge new art museum. And that is, I imagine he is probably the first leader of a major country ever whose first project was to build an art museum.
Absolutely. And see, that was
the only one.
And there's a lot of perceptions, you know, when you talk about the National Socialist architecture, you know, Albert Speer's name pops up. But actually, Giesler, who you've done an outstanding job in bringing back to the forefront of discussion, and Paul Ludwig Proust, who, you know, died before the House of German Art was completed, and actually his widow, you know, completed that project. Was actually responsible. And actually, in Germany today, there is only one building standing that Albert Speer actually commissioned and completed, and it's essentially a, for all intents and purposes, a public lavatory in Berlin. But yet, Giesler's and Troost's buildings are still standing, much to a lot of public appreciation. The House of German Art, even though the German government itself has relegated it to essentially decadence. They have a discotheque in there. There is no real permanent art exhibit there, but it is still there. It looks very much the same. It's, of course, stripped of the Eagles. And what's interesting, I want to make a quick comment about the Eagles, because during the National Socialist government, there were eagles everywhere, which I think eagles are beautiful, a symbol of nationalism.
They are. They are. And I do want to just throw in here that this to just say eagles doesn't give the idea of the beauty of these pieces of artwork in the form of eagle were put on various buildings, some of them very large. I mean, taller than a person, and they're put above doorways or something, and really elegant. And like you say, if the buildings did remain, if they were still standing and they weren't torn down by the Allies, they did remove all those beautiful decorations.
Yeah. But interesting, almost 70 years later, they still haven't been able to remove all of them, but they sure do try. When the one pops up that they missed, they'll go and take the pry bars and start prying them down, these beautiful eagles. But getting back to the House of German Art.
Yeah, and then the building doesn't have the elegance that it did.
No,
and of course,
no.
They don't want it to have it.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
But then, of course, that goes to what we talked about previously, Carol, is when you engage in cultural genocide, you attack the arts first. You attack the arts, and that's what the Allied Control Council did in the western part of Germany, and of course the Soviets brutally did it in the eastern bloc. Part of the country.
Well, there's plenty of that to talk about, but let's try to be upbeat and give our listeners some idea of what the architecture was and who the architects were. The most important early architect for the Third Reich was Paul Proust, T-R-O-O-S-T. And he renovated the Brown House in Munich, which was one of the early things that they did. They bought this building in Munich for the party. The National Socialist Party was serious right from the start in the early 20s because Hitler was serious. He took himself and his ideas seriously, even though the rest of the country and world didn't. You know, said, well, he's nobody, and they're nothing. They're never going to get anywhere. But he did, and they managed to buy this building, and they call it the Brown House, based on, you know, B-R-A-U-N in German, based on their brown uniforms, is what I understand. And Troost renovated that, and then Troost also is the designer of the House of German Art, the big, beautiful museum there, art museum there in Munich. Right?
Well, he did. You know, we're talking about Munich right now, and Munich, of course, is very, very important. It's essentially the birthplace, the headquarters of National Socialism in Bavaria and Germany, and Troost was so important in Munich. You know, not only did he do the House of German Art. And you look at that beautiful building and all of its from the outside, and then even from the inside. They haven't been able to tear it up completely on the inside and get rid of it completely. But then if you go, into Munich and you look at the National Socialist architecture, the buildings around the Königsplatz, the Troost was also responsible for, you know, the Führerbau, you know, the Hitler's official office.
Yeah,
his official office is in Munich. truth with response. That building,
and that's still there. These are buildings that are still there.
Yes.
The Fuhrerbau, a Fuhrer building, or whatever they want it, well, however we call it,
yes.
Is still there, designed by him. And also there's the party administration building was designed
yes.
by him. And
right.
it's still there, as far as I know, although you wouldn't recognize it from the way it was then, you know. But the
now
building
the
is there.
The Brown House was hit heavily by bombing. It was torn down. And now recently there was announced, and this is kind of interesting, they're building another memorial, a record center, you know, exhibit center, you know, of course, very anti-National Socialist on its site. It's a square cubicle, and of course, by a foreign architect. And this is very critical, Carolyn. What Hitler, the National Socialist, sought to do was to, I'm going to use a real bad grammar, but to re-Germanize German architecture and German culture. And let me give you a comparison into some of the statements that he made about, I'm getting back to cities. Nuremberg, of course, we talked real briefly about Munich. It was the heart of National Socialism. You had the Fuhrerbau, the Brown House, the national headquarters of the National Socialist Party.
Well, that was the party headquarters city. That
right.
was the party city, and which was under the National Socialists, if they had continued. I mean, that was extremely important because the party was, in a sense, the government, and so, you know, and the policies that they followed and the
right.
beliefs and so on. So it wasn't just like,
yeah.
you know, any old party. But so that was very important for that. And then Berlin was the government seat, you know, the national seat. And then Nuremberg was where they had another party city where they had the party rallies.
But there
so
was
it kind of gave... Yeah, go ahead.
There was but we missed something else. Getting back to Munich, we're immediately adjacent to the Fuhrerbau was the two Aaron temples, which housed the tombs of the martyrs of the 1923 Putsch, and that was an amazing.
Yeah.
Those were amazing architectural projects, and of course, those were completely destroyed by American troops. The tombs, the bodies, were exhumed. And this Aaron Temple was destroyed, but that was also developed by troops. But I'll give you a comparison. Nuremberg was the heart of the party rallies where every year people would march from all over the Third Reich, all over the Reich, from as far as Breslau and from
party
Königsberg
members.
And Prussia. Right, party members. Right, right. But it was significant.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
absolutely significant.
Well,
go into this Olympic Stadium where you'd have a seating of about 400,000 people. But there was a reason, because Hitler himself said that Nuremberg was the most German of all cities, while he described Berlin as the most decadent and, quote, nigger-loving. It had been so bastardized by international influences, and that is why essentially he had commissioned that tremendous plans to completely redevelop Berlin into Greater Germania. Because he wanted the architecture to reflect the people, the German people, and there's nothing wrong with that. There was absolutely nothing wrong with that. You know, and he is criticized for that by the leftists and by the multiculturalists. But yet you don't see them. The Soviets attempted the exact same thing when they annexed the northern half of East Prussia after the war. They leveled centuries-old palaces in what was German Königsberg, and when they renamed the city Kaliningrad, you know, they leveled centuries-old architecture and put up this monstrosity that they called architecture, which they called Soviet modern architecture, and all the leftists and the multiculturalists thought that was great because they said that architecture reflects their culture. Well, isn't that what the National Socialists were doing? They were developing architecture that reflected their culture, reflected their people, reflected their folk.
Well, yes, I'm getting a message from. He says he's listening in. I have to write a little something here to
okay.
our guest Wilhelm. I know I can't type straight. I asked him why he wasn't calling.
Oh, well, maybe he'll call in. Maybe he'll call in as we get further in. But we see in Nuremberg and the development of the party grounds. you know, the Congress Hall. Of course, the Congress Hall, you know, gives us a really good example. And the Congress Hall, you know, remains there. They still hold events in it. They had to do something with it. But what might have been on the great, you know, Congress Hall that would have been, that was planned for Berlin, which would have been considerably larger, you know, had the her Third Reich continued. And what's interesting, Carolyn, is I think it was last year I saw an interesting exhibit. The models, we see, all seen the scale models that in the black and white photos that were, you know, laid out in the new Reichschancellery of what was going to be the new Berlin, the new Germania. Well, a group of architects went and redeveloped all of those models, and they had an exhibit in Berlin in 2010. And it was widely received. I mean, people, they had lines for people going to see what Berlin would have looked like, and they actually ended up having to shut the thing down because they, oops, a little too popular there.
Oh, sure. People really want to know. They really want to know, but they're not allowed to know, which is why we're talking about, okay, hold on. He says he can't get through by calling the number. I don't know why. He's probably not waiting. Maybe I'll tell him to wait longer.
It could be after you push the code, there's a pin that you have to push, and that could be it.
Okay. Let's get all right. Well, so we were talking about Nuremberg. Now, the party, the yearly party rallies are very important, and so he put a lot of importance on having the right state, the right facilities, and the facilities that were designed there. And the original party Congress Hall was designed by Ludwig and Franz Ruff, R-U-F-F, and
mm-hmm.
it's on this beautiful Dutzenteich Lake. I used to know how to pronounce that when I was there, but I've kind of forgotten it, Dutzenteich. And this was done in 1935. But
yes.
The Congress, Party Congress Hall, was never finished. Later, I do believe that Speer worked on it, and because he seems to say have said that he had done all this, but it still wasn't finished. But that was because
yes.
of the war. But Speer designed the Zeppelin Grandstand, which is still
right.
there. These are things people can still see, all of this. The
yes.
Congress Hall is there. Although they have this horrible exhibit in there telling you how awful the Third Reich was, and all these busloads of tourists come there just for that, you know, and they take them right in there to see the exhibit. All these places that are still standing, from what I could see when I was there, that where they still have a National Socialist building still there, they make sure more and more. They haven't always, but they're getting to where they're getting them everywhere in all of them. They have these what they call documentation centers
That's
in there.
It.
And what they are is propaganda, you know, Jewish and allied propaganda telling you why this whole regime was so awful so that nobody will, you know, will think well of it. But if you can ignore that, you can go. I didn't go into the Party Congress Hall because I didn't want to see what they had done in there. I just walked all around the outside and looked at it in the courtyard, but I did go to the Zeppelin Grandstand, and of course in the pictures that we have from the time, it was just a magnificent place. But now it's kind of in a very bad way. I don't know if they'll even keep it there, but it's nice that it's still there enough that you can see it. And there are all kinds of other fields there and buildings, and it was just a magnificent large complex for the Nuremberg party rallies every year, and they try to say now that this was all a way it's all just part of the whole dictatorial, overbearing, you know, National Socialist Nazi stuff to take away people's free choice or something. Well, it was to inspire. It was to inspire those who were party members who came once a year and give them some, you know, speeches and talks, and they had some demonstrations, and then people marched past the grandstand and so on, all these different groups, the workers' groups and the, you know, the Hitler Youth and so on. And too bad Wilhelm's not here.
Yeah, he was there.
He gets here.
He could attest that he did not.
I told him to wait longer for the operator. Maybe he'll get on eventually. But he went 1 year, I think it was in 37, with his Hitler Youth group, and he marched in front of the grandstand when they did that. He said it was just a wonderful time. He was just thrilled to death. He'll never forget it. He's got a bunch of mementos from there. And he said he looked right into Hitler's eyes as they marched past, and they were very close to him. And, you know, they turned their head and look. And, you know, this it all depends on how you want to look at this. If this was the German people feeling happy and proud that they had come in, you know, were becoming an independent great nation of Germans again, or whether it was some, you know, racist force that the Zionist globalists thinkers want us to believe. But anyway, it was beautiful architecture, and Albert Speer, even though I'm sure he got some of his ideas from Hitler, you know, Hitler was always sketching out and handing them what he thought would be a good idea. He was a marvelous, inventive, creative builder, and he did a great job on everything that was in his that was his responsibility to do.
There's no project.
You know, well, he says it was September 1938. I don't know why he can't seem to call in. We might. I don't know.
I'll tell you, two of Speer's marvels, I think, was his lighting demonstration with the spotlights at the Zeppelin Field, and then, of course, the new Reichschancellery building. And, of course, there was no need to tear the new Reichschancellery building down. It was all a political move to tear that building down. But there's also one other, and it's going to be tore down fairly soon because it's been decommissioned. It's Tempelhof, what is now the Tempelhof Airport in Berlin. We're skipping back to Berlin a little bit, Carolyn. But that was completely what is the Tempelhof Airport. You go into the
let's go back to Berlin because I'm finished with Nuremberg for what I have, and there's a lot in Berlin to talk about.
The Tempelhof Airport was closed a couple of years ago, and the Berlin City Council and all its bureaucracy has been debating what buildings to keep and what not. So there is some opportunity to go and see Tempelhof Airport, which gives you an additional opportunity to see some beautiful Third Reich architecture as well before they tear down some, most, or all of it, and it becomes part of history as well. I've been following that. There was actually some public opposition. The public actually instituted some political action to try to save that as a historic landmark. And believe it or not, there was sufficient signatures in their very complicated and cumbersome balloting process. And the quote-unquote liberal democratic city leaders overrode the people and says, no, we're going to redevelop that, and that's going to be an infill project, much like the old Stapleton Airport in Denver, Colorado. So it's going to go away.
Well,
that one's going to go away.
There were, you know, a Tempelhof was an advanced kind of design, and most of what was going on in Germany, as you already said, was very advanced, and the rest of the world was looking at it and saying, wow, look at that, and wow, look at that. And, you know, it wasn't until, as we've mentioned before, 38, 39, that all of a sudden the Third Reich was becoming some kind of evil empire. But let's talk about some more that was in Berlin. There are a lot of embassies that were built during the Third Reich period. And let me just say that Werner March was another one of very good architects. His last name is spelled M-A-R-C-H. And he designed the Yugoslav embassy in 1938 and 40 it was built. And it has it has ornamentation of these little faces above some of the windows and so on that were designed by Arno Brecker. And I believe they're still there. Then he also designed the Olympic Stadium in Berlin. This was a major construction operation, of course, and he was the one that was given that. And there's a plaque there with his, bronze relief face there on it, saying that he was. And there you have a lot of sculpture you know, in connection with the architecture. The Olympic Stadium is there today, and it's being used. It's kept up. It's beautiful. It's in use. You know,
it's used as a musical venue. Yeah, it is used as a musical venue. Pardon? Now they did something I don't particularly care for. They put a
it's used as a sports venue.
Yeah, it's used as they put a fabricated
Olympic Stadium in Berlin.
Yeah, they put a fabricated
roof. Yeah, they put a roof on it.
Yeah, and they use it as a musical
venue.
Oh,
it looks nice, though.
Yeah.
Well, it looks nice, I think. And it is sports. They do have sports going on there. I don't know about the music. But there, some of the famous sculpture that's there that you can see are the discus throwers and relay runners by Carl Aberker.
Yes.
And there's Joseph Wackerly, or maybe Wackerly, Man with Horses sculptures. And he is also the one who did back to Munich, the Neptune Fountain, which is still there in Munich. It's in the old botanical garden, and that's by Joseph Wackerly. It's also very impressive. Somehow it survived the bombing, even though everything around it was destroyed, amazingly. Let's see.
The Olympic Stadium always surprised me that it did not get tore up and looted and destroyed more, but maybe it just had.
Well, I know. I think it's because it represented the German hosting of the Olympic Games in 36 or 37. In spite of the fact that Hitler was the chancellor at that time. And was, you know, the head of it all. But it's still, because it's part of the Olympic history, it would have been very unseemly for them to tear it all down. So they have it there, and it has, and this was done by the National Socialists, too. It has the list of all the winners, and Jesse Owens is listed there and so on. And here's something I want to stick in here, because this sticks in my craw all the time. You know, when you read about Jesse Owens at the Olympic Games, and in Berlin, and they always want to make out that Hitler was shocked and upset that he won all those races, where I'm sure Hitler expected him to win a lot of things, because everybody knew what a good runner he was. But here's the comment that's always said, and I read this in one of the things I was looking at, which is what brought it to mind, that somebody in this article wrote, "In this stadium, Jesse Owens disproved Nazi racial theory by winning 4 gold medals." Well, my answer is Nazi racial theory was not disproved because he won some running medals, because running is not equal to engineering anyway. So, you know, if it doesn't disprove anything about racial theory, we all know that that Africans are very good runners, you know,
and good at
a lot of sports. So
well,
it doesn't disprove anything. It's just so silly.
Carolyn, Jesse Owens came back to the United States and said openly that he was treated better in Germany by the German people than he was by his own, quote, people.
Well, I know, and everybody knows that. That's well known. But, you know, it's just that they keep saying that somehow this disproves racial theory or any kind of racial idea.
They just hope that, you know, the big lie, they keep talking about the big lie, and actually it's there. It's the multiculturalists that perpetuate this big lie. They hope if they keep repeating the same hogwash over and over, people will just wear down and believe it. And it's just not true. Getting back to the embassies, Carolyn, I'm glad you touched on those, because a lot of those survived, even the heavy street fighting in the Battle of Berlin.
Yeah, I've got a whole list of them here.
You know, the Italian embassy, which was done, and then the former Japanese embassy, those survived, and those were beautiful buildings. Those were very beautiful buildings.
I don't know about the Italian. The Japanese was designed by Ludwig Mosshammer.
And then there's the Norwegian embassy. Yeah, and the Italian embassy was designed by Friedrich Hetzfeld, and it survived.
Oh,
I'm not sure.
Yeah,
where
well,
it is
the Jap- they all survived. The Danish embassy, but I don't know who did that. Yugoslav I mentioned Yugoslav with Werner March. A Norwegian embassy was designed by Otto von Estorf and Gerhard Winkler. It was built in 1940.
Right. And, of course, the big building, Hermann Göring's air ministry, was untouched. It remained untouched. And you can go and it's now the finance ministry of the, quote, Bundesrepublik of Germany. It is now it operates in Berlin in the what was Hermann Göring's air ministry, but it was essentially untouched even during the street fighting. And you people, if you want to see it,
Ernst Seidel,
right?
34 to 36.
Mhm. And of course they peeled all the eagles
and,
off.
And then,
of course.
Oh yeah. But now, that's there. You can see it. But as you say, they got rid of all the decorations, which makes it special, and also what the surroundings would have been, you know, so that
right.
The surroundings are not the same. And as you said, the Berlin was always a place of the Sin City, you know, it's
mm-hmm.
more than any other place in Germany. And so, they've got it back that way again now.
But
another thing in Berlin that you can see that's, I think you can see some of them. I don't know about all of them. The three flak towers, there was one at the, these are amazing. Well, we have pictures of them anyway. And they're also beautiful. These were towers that built for anti-aircraft gunners on the roof to, you know, shoot down the planes that were coming in to bomb the city. And, inside the buildings, they had hospitals. They had places for people to go for safety. You know, they had what do you call that when you're? I can't even think of it now. The
air raid shelters.
You know, when you're air raid shelters and they had they were there. They could serve food. They had all kinds of things for the people inside there and places for soldiers to stay and so on. But they were like 12 feet thick walls or something. They're all made of cement. And the designs, each design is different. And in Berlin, there were three. They had at the Tiergarten, which they call the zoo, which is near the zoo, and the Friedrichshain and Humboldtian, and then in Hamburg there were two of them, and in Vienna they built three of them. You know, once they started having these bombing raids. From the English and then later the Americans too. So this did a lot of damage to those planes. But the thing is, the towers themselves were really impressive architecture.
Oh, they're outstanding.
I don't know, and they built them very fast too. Speer was in charge of that, and you know Hitler
right.
was saying, "Well, Jesus," he was so angry at all the damage that was being done, and that it seemed as though the Luftwaffe under Göring was not able to do what they were supposed to be doing, you know, to stop it, and they weren't able to actually produce enough planes. And this also was partly a mix-up in understanding, and Hitler was led to believe that all these fighter planes and all these planes and all these new bombers and everything were going to be built, but there was no way to do it. They didn't have enough labor, for one thing, and the plants were being bombed, so he was kind of given some information, led to believe things that couldn't happen, and so they were more vulnerable than he felt they should be, and he was very angry about it. So he said he came up, and he designed these towers too. He came up with his designs for this, and he handed it over to Speer, and he says, put it together like this and get these up. And Speer, who was very good at getting things done in a hurry, he was the best. He was a genius at organization, and these things went up like in a matter of months.
He built the new Reichschancellery building from start to finish in 11 and a half months. That is incredible for 1939.
Yeah, that was, isn't that, and it's beautiful.
Real quick, Carol.
Let's talk about that.
Let me back real quick before we go into that, Carol. Back to the House of German Art. There's something I really wanted to touch on. It'll take me just 60 seconds. In 1939, and this is something that people really. I'm going to put a. I finally was able to obtain a real good copy of this parade. But every year there was a festival, the House of German Art, the opening when there was an opening of the House of German Art. They had the new exhibit and such. But in 1939, and this was exactly about 2 months, so this would have been in July. This was still summertime. It was beautiful. And there was a major – it was the opening of the House of German Art. So it was July 1939. It was 2 months before the beginning of the war, the what we call a Polish campaign, because in the Germans' mind, the Polish campaign wasn't the beginning of any major war. It was a campaign to take care of other of some Polish atrocities. So it wasn't a war, per se. But anyway, there was the opening of the House of German Art, the opening of the new exhibition for that year, 1939, but there was this absolutely gorgeous and thought-provoking and lovely cultural parade. It was celebrating 2,000 years of German culture. And it's been mocked. It has been mocked and denigrated for 60 years. But if someone were to really look at that parade of the women in the traditional gowns, the men in the traditional attire, the children, I'm looking at some pictures right now, the sculptures that were being carried into that parade, and contrast that parade where people were embracing their culture. All of us marching down in front of the House of German Art, where people were embracing art, clean art, cultural art, their own culture, as opposed to, you know, the mayor of New York marching in a gay pride parade with people that are basically hauling around half nude.
Okay.
think about where we have come. Think about that society. Think about that civilization that is so denigrated and so, you know, attacked ferociously, and how that even that parade is attacked, as opposed to what we call parades.
Well,
and
sure.
Today.
Well, they're going to attack everything, and we have to get used to that. I mean, we have to be telling that to people as you're doing, so that they realize that this is nothing but hate, you know, and
absolutely,
that there was nothing wrong with the German Third Reich. It was a wonderful time. I wish I could experience it. I wish I could see all of that. I wish it could have gone on, and we would still have everything that was there. I wish we still had a Germany like that today. But let me mention Hermann Giesler here,
because
I haven't said anything about him, and I don't have anything too much to say except that some of the famous things that he designed. Well, one of his first important jobs was the Sonthofen Ordensburgen School, which was a school for SS party members. I don't think it was SS. I think it was party members, another party thing, to go to and learn all about National Socialism and become, you know, schooled in the thinking, you know, in a deeper way. And it was beautiful. It had a beautiful tower. There's pictures of it, but I think it's there. But it's in a place that I didn't go, so I didn't see it. But then in 1938, he was made general building inspector for the reorganization of Munich. So before that, it was Roderick Fick was another important architect. He was in charge of redesigning Linz from early on. You know, Hitler put him in charge. And he lived down around there. I think he was in Bavaria or something. And he also designed the SS barracks and other buildings at Obersalzberg, which was, you know, near to Hitler's home. But at some point, Hitler was not as happy with what he was doing, and he put Giesler in charge of Linz. But at first he put him in charge of Munich in 1938, and that was a very, very big job. The reorganization of Munich meant the whole redesigning, and he worked with Hitler on that and so on. And then Hitler in 1941 put him in charge of the Linz project. So he had a lot on his plate, plus he was doing all kinds of supervising all kinds of war construction, you know, in the Eastern Front zones. But he was a wonderful man. And most of these people were very devoted to Germany, and they didn't have any problem with their with the regime. Another one we haven't mentioned yet is Rudolf Walters, W-O-L-T-E-R-S, who worked for Speer, and he took over Speer's firm when Speer became armaments minister, which happened in 1941 when Fritz Todt, another important name, was killed. And he then took over major responsibility for the Berlin reconstruction. But by that time, there wasn't much they could do because everything had to go for the war effort. And that's what killed, you know, all the wonderful architectural developments that were going on, that were underway, was the war. You know, they just couldn't keep it all going. Another one was Julius Schulte Frohlinde, who, he constructed the DAF administration buildings, training schools, and helped plan the Kraft-Dirch-Freude, or work through joy. Wait a minute, I forgot what that means. The seaside resort called Prora, that's been in the news recently. That seaside resort, it's still there on the German island of Rügen. And it's that building that has all these extensions coming out of a main line so that all the rooms have windows. And it's on this Baltic Sea is, or on the water. And it was supposed to be a resort for the working people. So he's the designer of that, and he's the architect for that. Prora. Some listeners might they can look it up. It was in the news recently. They turned it into something else, but the German government has kept it, and pretty much the way it was, and it's been in use. It's some kind of a school or something now, but
it's been Carolyn,
it's also kind of unusual.
It's been redeveloped as a seaside resort, just like it was envisioned by the National Socialists, primarily for youth and young families. So far, they have about 50% of it redeveloped. But you're absolutely right. It is very much, they've not changed any of the architectural flavor at all. And, it is an amazing accomplishment. All the windows, you know, facing the Baltic coast, you know, so the sea air could actually blow into the windows. It's amazing. There's a quote I've actually found while we've been on the air, Carolyn, and this is actually from Adolf Hitler. Buildings better than anything else are able to express the National Socialist thoughts I just lost my place, but basically what Hitler was saying is buildings better than anything else are able to express the National Socialist thought in a permanent form. Absolutely right. And now, and you look at the buildings that still exist today, and look at how intricate they are, how beautiful they are, how lasting they are, and how permanent they are. Permanent, the key word permanent, we've talked about this before, great civilizations, they leave us a lasting legacy in their art, culture, and in their architecture. Rome left us the Colosseum. And regardless of what the naysayers may say, National Socialism left us a number of lasting legacies. Among them is the architect.
Can you think of that the term that was used that they say Speer invented the idea of ruins, ruin architecture? I can't think of the exact word, and I don't want to go looking up the page, but I've got too many things to do here. So, but it's some kind of ruin architecture where he recommended that the buildings that they really cared about be done with stone and in the old way, like they built in Rome, so that they fell into ruin, they would look like the Colosseum and buildings like that, and they would last forever, and even in a ruined state, there would be something solid about them, and that's how they thought at that time, because they were building for the long term, they believed.
Carolyn, I can't get to the quote now, but I believe that quote is actually in Table Talk as well, in Hitler's Table Talk. I believe there's a discussion, and I believe it's at the Oberzaun.
Well, yeah, they probably did. It probably is. It was in common currency. We haven't talked about Dresden and Weimar, and I have a few notes here about what can be found there in Dresden. There's some buildings that are still there, are headquarters of the Luftgau Commando 4. These are military buildings. It was built in 35 to 38 for the Luftwaffe, and it's still in use today by the military. And there's a Luftkriegsschule, aerial warfare school, which featured a large, beautiful Brecker relief sculpture named with the name of Der Flieger. It was like the flyer. It was, but it was like a Greek myth-looking person flying with, you know, lots of drapery and stuff. Beautiful, beautiful, very large on that building. I saw that, you know, you can see it in the pictures from then, but it's gone now. So the building is still there, but these are the things that they take away. And when we get to Brecker, we will, I'll just say it now, well, so I don't forget it, that, you know, of his work that was public, like this Der Flieger on this building, 90% of it was destroyed. 90%.
Oh, yeah,
the only thing, most of what remains of Brecker were, you know, art pieces that were indoors or, you know, that weren't part of public buildings. And a whole lot of his work was a part of public buildings. So, but another building in Dresden is the the Bureau for Food and Nutrition Administration building. It's still there and in use. It had a large eagle with swastika decoration over the entryway. Also gorgeous, just beautifully designed, very large. It's gone, and it's been replaced by a small winged train wheel, whatever that
yeah.
supposed to be. Really, a winged train wheel. well, then in Weimar, there was the famous Hotel Elephant, which is still there. That's a very interesting story. I saw that and I went inside. But, you know, it's all changed. But the outside is the same. Although there are pictures of Hitler there in 32 and 33 and probably 34. And then the facade was changed and kind of modernized and simplified by Hermann Giesler. And a small balcony was added over the entryway, and that was called the Hitler balcony because he would stay. He liked to stay in that hotel when he was in Weimar, and he would come out on that balcony and greet the people. So that has a lot of significance.
In Weimar also there was an Adolf Hitler Square, Adolf Hitler Plot, that actually Adolf Hitler was actually critical, helped design, was instrumental in actually designing that actual square. And, of course, it's, you know, the South.
I think that's the Market Square. Isn't it now the Market Square? I think it was called the Adolf Hitler Platz.
I have a couple of photographs of him with one of the, actually to the engineer, what we call engineer, and he's laying out and going over the actual scale model of what was Adolf Hitler Square. But you're right, it's the Market Square.
Yeah. And then they also had a Gau Forum there, which was never fully completed, but it's there, it says. It's a large complex, actually. It's a large complex for the Gaus. There was several buildings, and that was designed by Giesler. It was never completed because it was quite a few buildings, you know, several buildings all together in this complex. But some of them, the ones that were completed, are still there, used for some whatever. And there's a house of an office building that was housed the SS, SA, SJ, BDM, RAD, NSKK, and NSD, all party things pretty much, that had a big building there in Weimar. And there was also something called the Christ House. I don't know what the Christ is cross, I think, but it's Christ House of the NSDAP, another party building, that is there but without the eagle and swastika above the main entryway that used to be on it. So that's all I have for these particular buildings and architects. Did you want to add anything more about architecture before we move on?
Well, I'm just going back over. I just wanted to go through some of my notes. And the Adolf Hitler Square in Weimar is the Market Square, and that was a Hermann Giesler project.
Oh, was it?
Yes, it was. That was a Hermann Giesler project. And staying on Giesler, I just wanted to again reiterate, you've done a marvelous job on your website, you know, bringing him back to the, you know, public's attention. Isn't it interesting that when Hitler made his trip to Paris after the French capitulation, that famous picture of him, you know, with the Eiffel Tower in the background, the two men next to him on the right and left was Speer and Giesler.
And here's what I want people to know. Right next to Speer, always, was Hermann Giesler. No, you know who's on. In that picture, that's Arno Brecker. if you're looking at the picture, Arnold Brecker is on the right of Hitler, and Speer is on the left. And
right next
to Speer, although cut off in all these pictures, was Hermann Giesler, because Giesler and Speer would be standing together, and Speer always made sure that he was next to Hitler, always. Now, Speer was a marvelous architect, a marvelous genius of a man, but he had quite the ego, which someone like Hermann Giesler did not have, and was a very loyal National Socialist into Hitler. And so once the war was over, and once they were defeated, and he was arrested, and now he was in the hands of the Allies, he started changing his tune little by little. And at the Nuremberg trials, he said some things. He had such an ego that he didn't want to say he wasn't important. He knew how important he was, but at the same time later, he started really kind of trash talking Adolf Hitler, and he never did that. And according to Giesler and others, he said a lot of things about Hitler that were absolutely not true. He twisted things around to make it sound, tried to make Hitler look like he had no good taste, which was absolutely not the case. And he knew it when Hitler was around. He knew it. He did his work based on Hitler's designs, but he did all this, and it's really taken away a lot from him, in my opinion. But that you can't deny his ability as an artist and all the work he did. He did a wonderful job as armament minister.
Yeah, getting back to Paris, it's interesting, though, who Hitler took to Paris. It was Arnold Brechner, it was Hermann Giesler, and Albert Speer. And in all of those pictures, it was those three with Hitler. It was those three. And
well, that's
Giesler,
why he went on that trip. He went on that trip to see the architecture of Paris. He didn't go to see the paintings he didn't go in any galleries, or he didn't even go to see the sculpture. He went to see the architecture. And of course, he also wanted to go to Napoleon's tomb. He took his artists. He wanted to take the ones he called his artists were Brecker, Speer, and Giesler at that time.
Absolutely.
I think in 1940.
Absolutely.
And he had quite a discussion with them there about what they were going to be doing for Germany, and they were going to be different from France. He admired what the French had done. He wanted to see it, but he said, "We Germans, we have a kind of stricter lines in our architecture that fits our character and so on." He was just right on with everything. He was right on. I admire that man so much, because he was so intelligent. He knew so much. He had he had read so much, and he somehow retained it. And he could talk for hours on all kinds of subjects. And he had a tremendous grasp of the reality and the truth of everything he was interested in. So I don't want to go on and on about him more than that.
Well,
that's enough.
You know, the cheap shots you talked about that Speer took at Nuremberg after the war, you know, that Hitler didn't have any taste and all that. And this is something I always like to tell people. Well, really, look at his house. Look at the Berghof. Look at what he did with Wachenfeld and became the Berghof. Look at what you would see. I mean, that, American magazines came and featured that house. Architectural periodicals came and featured that house. To say that Hitler didn't have any architectural or design taste is a stretch. And, I agree with you that, Speer did an outstanding job in the aftermath of the death of Tote. It is disappointing the positions he took at Nuremberg, because there really wasn't any reason to do that. But, I do admire what he did at the lighting effects, with the aerial lights, and of course the new Reichschancery building. There hasn't been a building like that since, both in terms of architecture and design. That building particularly represented the new Germany, the Third Reich. It represented what Germany had become, where it was going. It just to have people pull into that court of honor when they would bring the visiting diplomats into that court of honor with the two statues of the army and the party, and then go down to the long hall to the Mosaic Hall. I mean, that building was designed for maximum effect. It was designed to represent the nation, and to me, that was Speer's hallmark. But again, that wasn't just Speer's work at all. You know, there was a lot of Hitler's influence in that building as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's one last thing about architecture. We could talk for 2 hours on that. Is that compare it to, and you sent me this over a week ago, this story on Dresden's Military History Museum getting a revamp with this crazy steel thing sticking out, the pointed thing sticking out from the front of it, huge, goes across the roof all the way to the back. It is totally out of character with the traditional building that it's been added to. And this Libeskind, or how you pronounce his name, Daniel, he's a celebrated U.S. architect, Jewish, and he was given the job of doing this renovation of the Military History Museum in Dresden. And it's just horrendous. It's horrendous. It's this new kind of stuff. What?
Well, you know, Carolyn, why is it? Okay, here, they're going to revamp the Military Museum in Dresden. So who do they get? They get an American who, you know,
well, sure.
firebomb the city, you know, the country to help firebomb the city. And
they own it. Since 1945, May, they own that country. The U.S. And so they do what they want. And all these politicians, like the mayor of Dresden and so on, they just can't go along with it fast enough. But this is just a perfect example of what you were saying, you know, of what how they want to destroy the whole philosophy of National Socialism or of Germany.
It's the culture itself. When they were going to rebuild the dome on the Reichstag, when they were going to reopen the Reichstag, it was a British architect that designed the new dome for the Reichstag, the Reichstag. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous that when they're going to do renovations or redevelop German landmarks, it has to be, preferably Jewish, a foreign architect or designer that does these landmarks and these redevelopments. Now, that building that the military museum is in, that is a former German military building. It was a museum in German history. Why they needed to bastardize it the way they did, of course, what they did was feminize it, which reflects what they've done to the country since, you know, May 7th, 1945. But that's the trend. That is the trend.
And I've got also a picture here I came across. I just thought I'd mention it real quickly. It's a new museum in Berlin. It's called the New Music Museum, and it's on a body of water here, real close. And it just looks like something Soviet, and it has this odd, strange metal part to it that's sitting on top of the roof and jutting out. It has no grace, no beauty, no aesthetics, no nothing. It's just flat, with these flat windows here and there. Maybe they're supposed to look like a keyboard or something, but musical notes or something. But I mean, it looks, I've noted here that it looks weak, it looks impermanent, it looks like something that's built and not last very long, and we can just throw it, trash it later, because it has no quality to it. And this is the kind of stuff that replaces what this horrible Adolf Hitler did. Let's go on to...
It looks Soviet. Doesn't surprise me. The city of Berlin, at German taxpayer dollars, still maintain and upkeeps all of those Soviet war memorials that they built in the aftermath of the war.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah, I mentioned that before, but, you know, if you go, particularly in what was East Germany, if you go around to those cities like Weimar and Dresden and so on, and you will find that any kind of statues that were up about National Socialism have all been were removed, and they were what was put up was communist sculptures, and they're still there. They're still there, but you won't find anything in any National Socialist sculpture or public statuary, but you do find a lot of everything that the communists put up. It's still there.
Well,
now,
I mean,
why would they want it there? That's just the different attitude they take between those two regimes that are both supposed to have been equally bad, you know, both both terrible. But
it gets worse, Carolyn. The victory column, the famous victory round, victory column, it was actually moved by Albert Speer and National Socialism to the East-West Axis. You know, it was built, you know, under the Prussian, under, I believe, Kaiser Wilhelm I is the famous victory column to celebrate the Prussian victories. That has been redesignated under what I like to call the German occupied government or the new Weimar government as not a Prussian victory column to celebrate Germany's prior military history, but the gay and lesbian memorial. And that is true. The victory column, which still sits in Berlin, has been designated as the gay and lesbian memorial.
All right, Rodney, let me try something here. I'm going to say is Wilhelm Christman, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
All right.
Well, wonderful. Well, look, he's been here, but he's just...
I don't know what happened.
He's listening or something. All right, well, join in. We want to hear from you now. We have been over an hour and 15 minutes without you.
Well, you covered a lot of areas there. I just wanted to mention a few. I don't think you told the story about the three Ordensburg, the party academies, which were built early 38, I guess, even earlier. And one of the architects was Hermann Giesler. He built the one in southern Germany, Sonthofen. And the other one was in the Eifel Mountains near Vogelsang. And the third one in Pomerania, Krössensee, which is now in Polish territory. And I understand it's they use it as a very busy kind of visitor center. And then another thing is
are all still there. All three of these buildings are still standing.
All three of them, specifically Sonthofen, was used and probably still used by the U.S. forces in Germany. It's down near Füssen in Allgäu, which is southern part of Bavaria, beautifully built and all in the typically granite and marble material. Vogelsang, each of them, all three of them, are very harmoniously joining the landscape. I mean, Allgäu, it's already,
yeah.
You have the Alps there. In the Eifel, there are the dark forests. In Krössensee, in Pomerania, it's the lake district and flat, slightly hilly country. Well, like all the architecture in the Third Reich, harmoniously built in the landscape and really beauty to look at and enjoy it. Also,
I wish we could show a picture of Sonthofen. That's
well,
the only one I'm familiar
also,
with, but I mean, it really is lovely.
I think you.
But it's very simple.
You mentioned a little bit the industrial architecture too, and military architecture. You know, when I joined the Luftwaffe in 1938, they transferred us to a new airfield in Lower Bavaria, Straubing in the Donau. And that was a completely new airfield, partly still building, but the barracks were, I still remember how we were surprised. those were not empty wooden barracks, but one-story stone barracks with all the facilities, laboratories, showers. And we were four soldiers in a room, and there was in the center a big sporting arena, and that was only not only in Straubing, but a year later I went up to the sea school at the Baltic Sea. The same thing. I mean, all the military buildings were architecturally beautiful. I think you mentioned the Luftkriegsschule, the academy in Dresden and in Gato, which were beautiful all around, large area buildings with all the statues and green parking space. Just tremendous here in the name.
Well, how would you explain, or can you explain why the Germans do everything with such, create so much beauty in what they design and in the way they organize things, when other countries do not do as good a job with that so often? Like, take the United States. If you look at U.S. military installations,
I think architecture is symbolizing the character of a nation in a certain decade. I mean, and the amazing thing is that in the 12 years of the Third Reich, this large projects were finished, not only on the military side or industrial side, but also in the art field. And that was the expression of beautiness, heroism, and idealism. Well, the decades before the Third Reich, the Weimar period, was symbolized by the Bauhaus, which was nothing else but the cathedral of Marxism.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because.
Absolutely.
All right, let's talk a little bit then. You know, we don't have a time limit for this show. We can go on as long as we want. So, maybe we can't. Maybe we only have 2 hours. I'd have to find out about that. But let's talk a little bit about the industrial, because as I understand it, Adolf Hitler had a different idea about architecture, industrial architecture, which he said could be in the modern style. It fit industrial, but it didn't fit government buildings or home, living buildings or anything like that, or art, museums and so on. He didn't want to see it there. But he said for industrial, the use of glass and steel and even, some of this Bauhaus-looking, modern, plain-looking style was fine. And they did build some of it that way, didn't they?
Well, one of the leading architects of the Bauhaus was for a short while even on the Third Reich architecture involved, this Mies van der Rohe. He left them for the United States. But did you talk about the Volkswagen, since we were shortly mentioning the industrial architecture, about the Volkswagen Werk in Fallersleben? Which has started and completed.
Why don't you tell us about, say what you want to say about that.
Well, it's running.
Go ahead, Wilhelm, and talk about that, Volkswagen Werk.
Well, this is, I never saw it, I saw the finished giant halls beside the industrial section, they had also the living quarters for the workers. There were, at the time, I think, during the wartime, they had workers there up to about 12,000 people. And then all the aircraft factories in up in Rostock near Berlin, down in Friedrichshafen, all of them were modernized, some of them and most of them newly built.
Yes. And they were, you know, they were built along different ideas than the other buildings that we've been talking about, because they were utilitarian, right? Now, the Volkswagen, maybe we should take some time just to mention, I did do some research on that today, and I don't have time to talk about all of it, but I think people need to understand and realize that the Volkswagen was entirely, designed by Adolf Hitler. It was his idea, and it's his design, and let me just say in May 1937, it was turned over to Dr. Ley, who was the head of Arbeit, and Dr. Porsche, of the Porsche Automotive Works, and the Dr. LaFerrance, who was the head of the Kraft Deutsch Freude, which was strength through joy. This was, you know, to find ways to do good things for the working class. And they made this car with made of steel, powered by a 25-horsepower engine with enough room for four or five, and they did hard testing on it, and it proved it could easily maintain a speed of 100 kilometers per hour on the Autobahn, so, and it only needed 7 liters of fuel for 100 kilometers, so that made it cheaper than public transportation. And so they knew they had a winner there, and it was all started by Hitler and his design. So he said it should be, well, he understood. He understood designing so well. He knew it had to not have any, what you call air resistance. He designed it so it would have not too much air resistance, and put that motor in the back and all of that. And it needed no repair. It was so successful, and they created this beautiful this city. Rodney was going to talk about cities that they had created, where they created a modern city around the first plant factory for the Volkswagen, and it had a population of 30,000. It was supposed to rise eventually to 60,000, and it was for the workers and managers of the car factory. And recreational opportunities and pools and showers and cafeterias and all kinds of things were free, and it just goes on and on. But the fact was that they weren't able to produce enough of these cars for all the people that wanted one because it was under $1,000 for the under 1,000 marks for the car, which was quite.
Well, you know, I remember that you could put up a savings account for getting the Volkswagen already early in 38,
yes.
And around all those industrial plants, and they had living quarters for the workers. And one family houses, most of them. I think in one of Giesler's book, he mentions the visit at the big steel factory in Linz, Austria, and then they went through the housing quarters of the workers there. And, you know, all those workers, before the war broke out, they had their paid vacations on the big DAF boats all the way up to the fjords in Norway, to Tenerife and Madeira, and media center there, so there was a lot of activities for the workers here, paid vacation.
This is the direction things were going, and it was just wonderful. And then when Germany was forced to defend itself in war, it got worse and worse, and they couldn't keep up all this stuff, and so people didn't get their cars after a while. And then there's the Autobahn, but let's maybe if we go on, we can talk about that later. Let's turn to the sculpture. Rodney, are you still there? You know, I'm just going to list some of the best known sculptors during that time. The two favorites of Adolf Hitler were Joseph Thorak and Arno Brecker. And they weren't just favorites of his because he had favorites, but they were the best. They were both, outstanding. Mm-hmm. But Arno Brecker was his most favorite, really. And we'll talk about his work and some other who did beautiful work. Fritz Klimsch.
Oh yeah, Klimsch
which I already mentioned.
Kolbe, don't forget him too.
Fritz who?
Fritz Kolbe, K-O-L-B-E. I think about 30, 40 sculptors. But the four outstanding were, as you mentioned, it's Brecker, Thorak, Kolbe, and Klimsch. And all of them, Brecker was a latecomer. I mean, he spent quite a few years with Rodin in France and came back to Germany in 1934. And from then on, he was the favorite of Hitler. And if you, there's an excellent book which was published in 1992 by the Graber Publishing House in Germany, and it's in English, French, and German, Ein Leben für das Schöne, Life for the Beautiful, and it's just amazing, the material of Brecker's work. I mean, I think he produced over between 200 and 300 portraits of busts of artists, politicians, and industrialists. And if you go through all those statues, I mean, the titles itself are very symbolizing about the idea of what the whole art and would mean and what he wanted to tell the nation and the people about.
Carolyn?
Yes.
I think it's important that note.
Hi,
that
guys. I'm back. I lost my connection, but I had to come back. Have you been?
Brecker,
go ahead with what you were saying.
I think it's important that Brecker, too, to the end of his life, never apologized or renounced his work on behalf of the National Socialist Government either.
Well, you know, he made a lot of, in the beginning, when he came back in 1994, there were some people accusing him of the French fellow. But I think he was the sculptor symbolizing the idea of the new Germany.
Absolutely.
And,
without a doubt.
You know, I think he, remembering my Greek history when I was 14, 18, and when the Greek, the one word, kalos kagatos, the beautiful and the nice one, the good one, those were the ideals. And you see it, the revival of Greek idealism in all the sculptures in the Third Reich at that time. You know, remember Phidias and Praxiteles, the Pallas Athene in the old ancient Greek and the Parthenon in Athens. Those were the symbols and really the prototypes for the new art in the Third Reich. And too bad that we can't show all the photos and the statues of Brecker and Thorak and Kolbe and Klimsch. Still, there are some of them are still around, but a lot of them have been destroyed during the Allied air raids and shortly after the war. Militias.
Did they just blow some of them up? Didn't they just blow some of them up? I saw a picture of two. I think they were the two. Sculptures, they look like the two sculptures that I have in the picture for the show. of the party in the Wehrmacht, but they might have been others. But they were in a like somebody's backyard with laundry hanging there, and they were laying down on the ground broken up.
Yeah, well, you know, at the Olympic Stadium today still, there are some statues of, I think, Kolbe and Brecker.
No, it's not Brecker at the Olympic Stadium. I thought they were Brecker when I was there. But at the Olympic Stadium, it's, let me get that here.
Well, I think it's Mach who built the stadium.
But he designed it. But the sculptures at the
just
Olympic
somebody,
Stadium are by...
Yeah, it might be Klimsch.
Oh, I have to, who knows where I've got that. I got.
Well, you know, at the time when I was in Berlin, I picked up the staff
Waterloo
officers at the Olympic Stadium, and there were the monuments there and the big two towers, called the Marathon Gates, very, very, very... Well, did you find who designed the statues at the Olympics? No.
Well, I will, but, you know, Thorak had some works at the Marsfeld in Nuremberg, at the Marsfeld, the rally grounds. He did this gigantic Goddess of Victory, which I think exists, but not in the grouping that it was meant for, because it wasn't all completed. But, maybe they just had the models of it, but he was working on it, this picture in his studio. You know, Thorak had a gigantic studio, pictures inside of it. You see, he's got...
Well, you're both of them, Thorak and Thorak.
Yeah,
and Brecker.
Yeah, but Thorak worked even much larger than Brecker ever did.
Yep.
And he's got, there's big ladders and cranes in there, you know, and you see the person with a horse down below, because he did a lot of horses, and so he had a horse there as a model.
Yeah.
And just tiny, like little... play toy soldiers or something, you know,
Thorak had this big studio outside Munich. You know, he was born in Salzburg, and I think he built the one giant monument for the Autobahn from Munich to Salzburg. I don't know if what it was ever put on the Autobahn or just stayed in his atelier. And Brecker had a giant studio outside Berlin, I think still today there is a Brecker Museum, I think somewhere in the Rhineland, maybe outside
Duisburg. Yes, there is, and I have some information about it. This Brecker Museum was built but here, I don't know if this is at the Brecker Museum, but in 2006, at the Schleswig-Holstein House in Schwerin, the capital of the state of Mecklenburg-West Pomerania, they decided to exhibit 70 works owned by Brecker's widow. And they did so, and there was a lot of controversy about it, of course. People from the left said it was a big mistake, and you know. But the person who wrote this up said that Brecker was a genius and should not be judged by political standards. You know, his art should not be judged by political standards of the day, which, of course, it shouldn't be. But, you know, the fact is that 90% of his pre-1945 work was public work, was destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think a lot of his portrait busts must be still around and owned by private people, because there were all in all, if I remember correctly, close to 300 portraits.
Well, I'm looking for this. I don't know what I did with that.
Carolyn, if I can interject, there was a concerted effort, because the late Hans Schmidt left us two outstanding books that he wrote, and he touched on this, and he gave some photographs of some of the Brecker sculptures, and there was a concerted effort in the post-war Germany to just absolutely just demolish sculptures that anywhere could be construed as nationalistic or militaristic in nature, and those sculptures were destroyed, including sculptures that were affixed to graves. And but you're absolutely correct. A large majority of Brechner's statues, because he was considered the quote unquote boogeyman. You know, bear in mind, you walked into the Grand Hall of Court of Honor of the new Chancellery. It was his work you walked past, and rightfully so. And it's a shame. You know, now when you hear the great instructions of U.S. troops going into Iraq and Afghanistan to be sensitive to the enemy's culture and art, you know, that wasn't the case, and it's probably really not the case now. But the cultural, again, as you know, we talked about it in prior shows, this was part of the cultural genocide. You know, sculptures were just smashed. And it was, red marble in the old, and the Reich Chancellery was made in the subway stations, and one of the Soviet war memorials is made out of the red marble from the Chancellery building.
That's right. They destroyed that Reich Chancellery, that beautiful building.
Well, Caroline, you
Caroline,
you and Nuremberg, weren't you?
They built the Soviet memorial in honor of the Soviet soldier, the Red Army.
Caroline,
you were
in Nuremberg, Caroline, weren't you?
Yes, but let me just tell you, I just found the information that we were looking for, Wilhelm, and the sculptures that are at the Olympic Stadium in Berlin that are there now. The two where there's two men together, two athletes standing together. One is discus throwers, and the other is relay runners. They're by Carl Abacher. I never had heard of him, and they don't say who they're by on them. You know, so when I was there, I thought they were by Brecher or something. But they're by Carl Abacher, and then they have those wonderful man with horse sculptures. I think there's more than one. There's one that you always see the picture of, but there's more than one there. And those are by Joseph Wackerle.
Oh.
Is that how you pronounce it? It's spelled with a W, but...
Rodney, do you have any idea what happened with Karinhall? You know, Göring's...
I can speak to that. I can take... Karinhall was a beautiful, beautiful estate of Göring's. He used to entertain visiting diplomats. There's many a film, newsreels of events at Karinhall. His art exhibits were there. You know, he was very much a outdoorsman type of architectural design. There's famous clips of him with his pet lion cub there. And he also had of course, Karinhall was named in honor of his first wife, who was Swede. She was from Sweden.
Oh yeah, well,
and he had a tomb. He had a tomb. He had her entombed there underground, an underground tomb. And as Soviet forces got close, the Red Army, the U.S. allies got close.
That was, Karinhall was outside Berlin, northeast, of the forest there.
It was northeast of Berlin, and as the Red Army got close, he actually he had Fallschirmjäger troops demolish it, and then he withdrew. He actually withdrew to Berlin for war conferences. And, of course, he did not have time to evacuate his first wife's body, but there was some thinking that, you know, bodies would not be desecrated. Well, the Soviet troops did indeed desecrate his first wife's tomb, scattered her remains around the grounds, and actually her family from Sweden petitioned the Soviet government, and they went and collected them and reburied her in Sweden. Now today there are still marks. There are still marks going in from the main posts going in from the main gate where Karinhall once exists. And that's all that exists of what was Karinhall.
Well, Rodney, I remember now. It just came to my mind at the Olympic Stadium. I visited a free die Dietrich Eckart Bühne, where they called it kind of an open air theater.
Yes.
What happened with that?
It does not exist. A lot of you know what was in Nuremberg at the Hardy grounds are gone. A lot of the Congress grounds, which you see, you only see about 20% of what actually was there. A lot of the columns and such, where the famous eagles were, rested upon, those are gone. And a lot of the main buildings are actually gone. What you see is the Zeppelin Field is there. Where the parade grounds are there, but that's all that's left.
Close by, and in September 1938, we were camping there in a big camp town, or really city, and but there must have been between 30,000 and 40,000 youngsters from all over Germany.
You had the honor of being at the last party rally, and the first one where Austrians had gone to the party rally.
Yeah, we were, from my home province, from Kärnten, we were about 300, somewhere between 300 and 400, and that was a privilege, many more than all the other districts in the Reich, and we were all jointly camping in a big tent area. I think it was called Langwasser. And then we marched, my goodness, I remember then the march, and then all the at night, the big dome of the searchlights, that was the, I think it was either the idea of Speer or of Leni Riefenstahl, and the exercise.
I think it was Speer. I've always read it was Speer's idea.
That was
incredible, too. What an effect it had.
Could be spared, but Leni Riefenstahl was very important in with her influence of the of documentary. I mean, she was pioneering something unusual, which is still today acknowledged by documentary experts. The whole film, the movies about the Parteitage, but also the movies about the Olympic Games. Extremely successful.
Leni Riefenstahl.
That was all a great triumph, and it was done the German way, not the Nazi way. It was done a German way because Germans are good at that, and they did a wonderful job of hosting that Olympics, and everything they did was just right, and everything they created and built for it was beautiful.
Completely new.
I'm not saying others don't do a beautiful job.
Completely.
Also, but that was a beautiful Olympics. Let's kind of get back to the sculptors. I wanted to mention that this Fritz Klimsch, who there is a sculpture of his that is still existing that can be seen. It's a public sculpture. It's the Looker, Die Schauende, Wilhelm. It's a nude female that's looking out at Lake Chiemsee, or Lake Chiem. The Chiemsee, which means the Chiem Lake, Autobahn rest stop, and that's still there, I think. It's the Autobahn rest stop in southern Bavaria. That was one of the first. That was the first rest stop, highway rest stop, I think, that was maybe ever existed.
Any place. You're absolutely right, Carolyn. That was the first. The concept of rest stops and interstate highway system. That was the first, the whole, again, 20 to 25 years ahead of their time, ahead of any other nation.
Well, yes. But this was they built this rest stop there, and it was quite elaborate. It wasn't just an ordinary rest stop. I mean, it had lodging. I think it had lodging, but it had a big restaurant. You could swim in the lake there. It had an area where you could swim. It had all kinds of nice things, and of course, you'd gas up. And there was this female nude sculpture that must be fairly large, but they've got it out there on the water, kind of on a ledge looking out, and it's turning and looking back. It's a beautiful sculpture. It's lifelike, but it's a little bit slightly expressionistic because the waist of this female is very small. It looks almost, it could be, but it isn't quite as Greek-looking as some of them. So it's very nice. And then, this, as I said, there's the Neptune Fountain in Munich, Wackerle, which I don't know if I saw that or not because I didn't know about it. And if it's somewhere off the beaten road, I guess I missed it, darn it.
There's another feature of architecture which you'd mention, and those are the bridges. The bridges on the Autobahn and across the rivers. Remember?
Yes. Wilhelm just stole the thought right out of my mouth. Look at the character of the bridges of the Autobahn at the time. Just the character and the style.
Well, one of the first ones was the Mangfall Bridge here near in southern Bavaria. And then across the Danube, the Nibelungen Bridge, which was really finished, part of the renewal of Linz, which Giesler was supposed to take care. Well, he did. All the plans were finished and the models were finished. But there was some work done along the banks of the Danube and some widening of the small streets leading from the Danube to the railway station.
And also Fritz Todt, who was in charge of the Autobahn, and he worked to make it a beautiful. He got together with. Where do I have this? He got together with an artist. He got together with some kind of designer, and they worked to make it very beautiful. And then, I'm looking in the wrong place. That's why I'm looking under Volkswagen here. He got together with, I'm stuck on this, Alvin Seifert. He engaged the landscape architect Alvin Seifert, especially for the Munich to Salzburg portion, which was the most beautiful because it had the most fantastic.
Yeah, it's
and
quite a
thing. Where they wanted to direct traffic to Lake Chiem.
It's the Rathaus on the Chiemsee. That's what he did.
Yes, and so this was where they did so much of that really exciting work and bridges and so on, so that they could take the traveler through the most beautiful areas. And it seemed to be nothing was in their way. I mean, they had some fantastic ones. You know, in the book, by that. You guys go ahead. I'm going to look.
Carolyn, can I touch on something that I think is really important and it kind of ties everything together to what we're talking about?
Okay.
In 1937, there was an international exhibition in Paris. And nations had, had set up pavilions, and they were built. They actually built pavilions representing their nations at this exposition in 1937. And what's interesting is the German pavilion was immediately just across from the Soviet pavilion.
Oh yeah.
And what's interesting, you look at photographs, but you don't have to look at photographs from today. And of course, I will admit, and I'm sure Wilhelm will agree, Wilhelm and I are biased, but the world talked about how the German pavilion was just beautiful. The lighting, it mixed the architecture, the sculptures, it was topped with an eagle, of course. And, of course, the Soviet pavilion immediately across from it was god-awful, just absolutely ugly. And of course, compared to the other pavilion.
I've seen pictures of
it was
there. I wouldn't say it was god-awful, absolutely ugly.
It was the swastika.
It was the swastika
versus the Red Star. And I think part of it, the Trocadero, is still today there in Paris. In the interior, also, I think a very important part of architecture is the interior, the furniture, the carpets, the use of different marbles, primarily Carrara and Travestine from Italy, and then the famous Untersberg marble from Salzburg with this slightly reddish color and the beige kind veins in there. A very, very important interior architecture in the Zürich.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this brings up that they're always saying that the Nazis had no taste. They were like barbarians, and they had and you know this is so easily disproved, and it just it isn't the case at all. I mean, everything that was being done there, and it was being done by Nazis, it was in the best of taste.
Well, it was being done by Germans,
And of course,
it was being accentuated and it was being supported by a government that supported real culture, a German art, and we can say wholesome, but actually, you know, it was a lasting art and culture. And
one of the great bridge designers was Paul Bonatz. Does that ring a bell, Wilhelm? Bonatz. And I've got some pictures of some of the bridges here. There's one over the Lahn River at Limburg and over the Stuttgart-Ulm Autobahn. There's some magnificent-looking pictures. Here's one at the Rhineland, a stone bridge near Rhineland-Palatinate.
Well, the first one...
These aren't even in the south, in the southern part.
Right, and the first big bridge was the Mangfall Bridge in... Upper Bavaria, and crossing a deep gorge, and the Autobahn there, you know, just the first Autobahn leg from Munich towards the Austrian border, but they're just beautiful, harmoniously lined through the whole landscape, and it was just not a cement line, but in between the green grass areas, that was a new one too, and then the two or three resting inns which were already built at that time, and later on, I mean, then the lake along the Rhine Valley, and then the one from Frankfurt to Darmstadt, and the one from eastwards all the way up to Rostock, just unbelievably built into the landscape and not disturbing at all the people.
A few facts about the Autobahn, because they like to say, the ones who want to tear down the Third Reich, they like to say that, oh, that Autobahn was started long before Hitler, and it wasn't his idea, and he just took advantage of other people's ideas and then, you know, got credit for it. Well, you know, there was a discussion about, you know, highways and so on, and not only in Germany, but in Italy and France and other places, but nothing too much had been done, and there was an Autobahn segment that was built between Cologne and Bonn in between 1929 and 1932, and it took 3 years to build this segment between Cologne and Bonn. Then in 1933, Hitler took over, and he made some changes, and he moved to centralize highway planning and road construction, and he changed it from the Hamburg Frankfurt Basel.
Did you mention that?
To something larger, a whole network in Germany, and it was called basically the Reich's Autobahn. And anyway, he inaugurated, and they made their first cut of the spade in Frankfurt in September 1933.
Uh-huh.
And in between 1933 and 1938, they added 3,000 kilometers of Autobahn network. So, you know, the other took 3 years to do just a short distance, whereas in this 5-year period, is it? They did 3,000. And then what got in the way after was that
right.
The war took, you know, it was the war. And all that needed to be done for the war, so they weren't able to make too much progress. They only added about
800
kilometers after that. Hmm?
Dot was the father of the Autobahn. His idea was then Well, later on, unfortunately, he was killed very early in an airplane crash. But the organization
Well, now
thought...
listen to this, Wilhelm and Rodney. I have to say this because another thing, I was looking at a site today. Well, it was about.com. They had a timeline on the Autobahn. That's where I got some of this information. But they want, of course, put down Hitler all the time. And here's what they say on here. This is an example of internet perfidy. They say 1942, Fritz Todt is killed in a plane crash in East Prussia on 8th February. There is speculation that Hitler had a hand in his death. His successor is the architect Albert Speer. Can you imagine sticking that sentence in there with no source, no nothing? I've never even heard that before. Speculation that Hitler had a hand in the death of Fritz Todt. He was very upset, you know.
Well, you know.
But this is the kind of stuff they do.
They do this, and they're going to continue to do it as more of these facts and the truth comes out, and the more people begin to look at the way life, mm-hmm. you know, really was, and the more people begin to think for themselves, this just means we have our work cut out for us. And you challenge people, you know, I like to run into the person that wrote that and say, hey, where's your source on that? Cite your sources. And, of course, it's probably...
Yeah, I've never seen any speculation like that.
Well, yeah, just like the speculation, those article in the book that came out that said that, you know, Hitler's hospitalization had nothing to do and his eye injury had nothing to do with the gas attack. It was psychosomatic.
Yeah.
I mean, all of this stuff is just going to keep coming out and coming out. So.
Well, that's right. Wilhelm, what more do you have to share with us about the sculptors or the architecture?
You mean what I think about Speer? I couldn't get you.
Well, we kind of talked about that. But yeah, tell us what you think about Speer. That would be very interesting.
Well, you know, I have both his books, his Spandau Remembering, and then he was a very highly intelligent man, but he was an opportunist too. And I think accusing himself during the Nuremberg trial as one of the instigators of crime saved probably his life, but it didn't save him of the 25 years he has to spend at the Spandau jail. And after he was released, after the 25 years, in his interviews and books, I mean, he devastating statements denying all his heroic actions and dedications during the 12 years in the Third Reich. I think it's characterless, I think.
Yeah,
and there are
do you think that he convinced himself that that was true, or you have an opinion on that? Nobody knows, but he's just able to do that. He's just able to turn like that without caring, or he got.
You know, one
of the Allied thinking that he was disgusted with himself or something, or you know what in the world? Besides saving his life, I guess, but then he continued with it afterwards.
I think
he wants to get along with all the people in the world today, and I guess he can't get along with them. Well, he's dead now, isn't he? But he couldn't get along with them if he was going to continue to say good things about Adolf Hitler. So, so he went the other direction, which is, yes, a lack of character. That's what it is.
Well, I think it's very indicative. There's one of his best friends. I think, Caroline, you mentioned his name, Wolters.
Yeah, Wolters.
Yeah, after the war, when he found out what happened at Nuremberg and his interview with the Playboys and the books, he was just criticizing so badly Speer, giving up his friendship and accusing him of kind of being a traitor of his own life.
Mm-hmm.
Carolyn, what's sad is
that
Speer
That was a difficult thing for him, and that was all a big scandal, kind of.
Carolyn, Speer traded
Speer did this so many wonderful things for the Third Reich. But again, yeah. You know, almost everything that he did, it was Hitler. Maybe I'm wrong. See, tell me what you think of this. It was I don't want to take away from his great ability, but it was Hitler who came up with the basic idea and said, let's do it like this, and then Speer would go ahead and do it like that and do, you know, maybe add some of his own, you know, and do a fantastic job. But I don't know what Speer's own ideas would have been. What is there that is designed by him that you would say what he did maybe pre-Hitler or you know, what he did altogether on his own? Nobody knows.
Carolyn?
Yes?
Speer had no career pre-Adolf Hitler. And Carolyn, one final comment from me, and I have to get off the air. I'm being called away by my kids, but Speer at the end in 1945 sacrificed and gave up his comrades to curtsy favor with his enemies, and he had to carry that, and in the end he gave up his honor. And, you know, yes, he did do some great things, but, you know, your fundamental question, what did he have prior to his work with the Third Reich? Nothing. And he did do some great things, but he did give up his comrades and sacrifice his comrades in his honor to curtsy favor with
the
enemies.
Well, I think he did them in conjunction with Adolf Hitler and his ideas.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So,
what do you think of that, Wilhelm? And then we're going to let you go in just
a
minute.
Well, you know, there's in Hermann Giesler's book, The Art of Hitler, there's quite a long chapter when Giesler reports all his doing during the war, before the war, which Speer as a kind of a competitor, and how Speer tried to outdo him at Hitler
Yeah. There's a lot that can be said against the man as a human being. Well, that's too bad. But you know, Hitler really liked him, and they had a very good relationship. And so he was maybe kind of like a chameleon. You know, he could be what he needed to be, and he seemed to be. He worked very hard as the armaments minister, and he did a very good job, as you've told me. So it's not that he couldn't do a good job and that he didn't do a good job for the Third Reich, but then when the Third Reich was out of power and he just got along with those who were in power. Well, gentlemen, we're going to bring this program to a close. We're just a little over our closing time, and I want to thank you both so very much for your contribution tonight, and I'm so glad you finally got on, Wilhelm. Thank you, Rodney.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's been an honor to be with Wilhelm again, and thank you again for the opportunity.
Oh, and let me tell the listeners, if there's any listeners left, but that people will be listening to it when it's archived. So next week we are planning on doing another threesome. And we're going to do, as I said at the beginning of the program, education in the Third Reich. And there's a lot to be said about that. I'm very excited about that subject. So are you both willing to come back for that next week?
That'll be the best show of them all.
Well, I'm sorry that I came a little bit late in there, but I was listening in, and I think it was a very good discussion on the day. Good night, Dale.
Well, I hope so. I'll be interested in listening to it myself tomorrow. So thank you both again very much. One thing about this, I'm not interrupted by the crashing music, you know, so I can say a proper goodbye to you and close the program. And so this is the end of our sculpture and architecture in the Third Reich. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening, and do come back next week for another program about the Third Reich, this time on education. Thanks to my guests again, and good night to all.
Thank you.